From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On the evening of February 26th, in a suburb of Orlando, Florida, Trayvon Martin, a 17-year-old African-American, was shot and killed by a neighbor.
Martin was at his stepmother's. He went to buy some Skittles during halftime of the NBA All-Star game.
Neighborhood watch leader George Zimmerman called police to report a suspicious black man. Before police arrived, Zimmerman confronted the teenager, and during a scuffle, Zimmerman shot him in the chest, killing him.
Well, was it self-defense or murder in cold blood? The family of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin says it was murder, and there is new evidence that may help prove their case.
Florida law establishes relatively broad latitude when it comes to killing in self-defense. In fact, self-defense does not even have to be proved. Floridians can stand their ground and shoot if they feel threatened, even in a public place. George Zimmerman was not charged or even arrested. This week, a federal investigation was launched. The police chief in Sanford County, where the killing took place, stepped down temporarily. And in New York, protesters called for justice for Trayvon.
We are Trayvon Martin! We are Trayvon Martin!
But for weeks, the story earned very little national attention. The Huffington Post's Tremaine Lee is one of the few reporters who covered the story early on, after local sources in Florida called him with some compelling details.
You have an unarmed teenager who, by all accounts, was an all-American boy. He had a pack of Skittles in his pocket. You have an armed neighborhood watch captain within a gated community. Everything about this, the flag started going up, and I immediately knew this was something that was going to be important to our readers.
When you got there, and that was long before the story made national news, did you notice a dearth of other reporters?
It was just local TV reporters, mostly. There was a reporter from the Orlando Sentinel. An AP writer would show up from time to time. But even at that, I didn't see any wire stories coming out, really anything in depth at all. And I was pretty surprised, because if there ever had been the perfect story to tell, it would be this one, because even before we got to 911 tapes, the basic details were so shocking. The basic details, I would imagine, would obviously resonate, but apparently they didn't.
Why do you think this didn't register immediately?
I think we're still dealing with complications of race and stereotype, even within our newsrooms. And if you've ever spent any time in a newsroom, you do understand that we have that same as the garden variety killing. And unfortunately, I think just on its surface, this might have fallen into that category of just another garden variety killing. But I think once the 911 tapes were released, and you hear the sobs of the neighbors, you hear the gunshot, you hear what appear to be the cries for help and the pleas, the screams of what most of us assume is the young man's screams, I think that's the moment when it finally resonated and it was crystal clear.
911, do you need police, fire, medical?
Maybe both, I'm not sure. There's just someone screaming outside.
And is it a male or a female?
It sounds like a male.
And you don't know why?
I can't see him. I don't want to go out there. I don't know what's going on.
So you think he's yelling help?
Yes.
All right, what is your phone number?
There's gunshots.
That, with the pictures that we've been circulating from the family of this young, fresh-faced kid, the details of this 28-year-old man who, you know, outweighed him by 100 pounds, once we started getting those details, that's when the media realized, like, okay, we better hop on this. And also, social media. Friends by the thousands were sharing this with their circles, and that's kind of really where the steam picked up.
It seems like it's received widespread mainstream media attention in a way that many other stories involving black men killed in questionable circumstances have not. Is it something about the media changing, or is it something about the political moment, or is it something about the peculiarities of Florida law?
It's a very complicated, dynamic situation. But even when you look back to, say, 2006 and 2007, we had the Sean Bell killing in New York, when the cops fired dozens and dozens of shots into this vehicle, killing him just hours before he was to be wed. Twitter hadn't emerged the way it has now. Facebook hadn't emerged the way it is now. Now, everyone can immediately get this information out. And you couple that with the political tone of the time, with this Florida laws, the Stand Your Ground laws, which some have called the Make My Day laws or the Dirty Harry laws, that allows anyone to use deadly force against anyone they feel is threatening them. And so it's kind of the perfect storm here. With the Huffington Post, of course, we're online. And so early on, I saw the stories were being shared by 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 people on Facebook, thousands of comments. It was clear that part of the driving force behind this story was the ability for people to share it quickly and easily.
You know, I was reading The Atlantic's summary of this story and its transit into the headlines. And three of the earliest, most important people to put it there are you, the New York Times' Charles Blow, and Ta-Nehisi Coates. We're talking about three black journalists making sure that this story becomes part of the national conversation. I just think that makes a very strong argument for diversity in the newsroom.
It's kind of the other side of the coin when we see the fair-skinned, blonde-haired woman go missing and the entire media hops on it. Most of the newsrooms are full of, you know, mostly white people, and I think that it's natural. You see your niece, you see your daughter, your mother, your wife. In this case, I think none of us could deny, as black men, Ta-Nehisi and Charles Blow and myself, that you can't see a little bit of yourself in a Trayvon Martin. But what is really interesting, now you've seen people from all across the economic and racial spectrum who are hopping on this case, because so much of it, though the case seems to have begun with an act of racial profiling, it ended with something so much more. Folks are saying it's a morals and ethics issue, and I think that's where we are now.
Tremaine, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. I definitely appreciate it.
Tremaine Lee writes for The Huffington Post. Ta-Nehisi Coates is a senior editor at The Atlantic. He says that he read about the story for a couple of weeks before he started writing about it. It felt too sad and too familiar to cover, and he was too used to writing about similar stories that were routinely ignored by the media.
Generally, this stuff just sort of goes away, and I think as someone covering it, you sometimes get subject, regrettably, to a sort of fatigue.
So why did you start writing about it?
One of the things that happens is that on the blog that I run for The Atlantic, they have a daily open thread. And I went in there one day and I saw that they were talking about it. And I said, actually, I posted in the thread, I said, you know, I've known about this and I've been following this and I've been reading about it. And I cannot bring myself to write about it. It's just entirely too depressing. And something about saying it made me realize that, in fact, I had just started writing about it. And so if I was going to write about it, you know, in a comment section, I needed to come out and talk about it. And then it just kind of blew from there in a way that I really, really didn't expect. The thing to remember is for weeks, Trayvon Martin's parents were trying to get access to the 911 tapes. The chief of police was refusing to release them, not only until his report was done, but until the prosecutor's report was done. Basically, that would have been months. Some amount of pressure did build, and those tapes were released. Zimmerman says that it's him screaming on the tapes, that he was actually screaming for help. That may well turn out to be true, but I just have to say, listening to those tapes, it sounds a lot like a child. It's just absolutely, absolutely horrifying.
I was looking on the Atlantic site, and they had a kind of TikTok of how the story made its way onto the front pages of American newspapers and in the leads of TV news programs. And it seems to start with Tremaine and you and Charles Blow. You were early writing about this story.
Not as early as Tremaine, no, it was especially early. I can't speak for Tremaine and I can't speak for Charles. I will tell you this, my interest in these sorts of issues date back to my time as a student at Howard University and having a friend who was killed by a police officer who had done nothing and feeling that no one would care. I will live with that for the rest of my life. These are not abstract issues for a lot of us. Some of us, I know myself, who have been stopped by police, have been encounters that we thought could have gone another way. When we see these cases, we see our sons, we immediately see us. It sounds like, you know, it's highfalutin or metaphorical. I don't know how I can make that any more real. It's like covering a war when you actually live in the war zone. It's a very, very real, present, horrifying possibility.
Do you think that the story of the death of Trayvon Martin could be the beginning of a tipping point where these stories do get the attention they deserve?
Well, I think it depends on what sort of tipping point you're talking about. I think it might be a tipping point for stand your ground laws. Just this week, there was a gentleman who got off on a stand your ground law. Judge dismissed the case. He saw somebody stealing his radio from his car. He went to chase the thief, withdrew, ran. He chased the man down and stabbed him to death. He claimed the guy made a stabbing motion, so that was why he felt threatened. I think those sorts of cases will experience a lot more scrutiny in a way that they didn't before. As to the general issue that brought me to this case, how young African-American men interact with police, people claiming police powers who are in fact not police, that's going to be a long, long, long fight.
You have a hugely popular blog, and you have an extraordinary relationship with your readers, and there are a lot of them. Mm-hmm. You cover the big issues of the day, mm-hmm. but you were resistant to this one. I know this is the question I started with.
Right.
Was it your readers really who compelled you? Was it simply in response to what they were saying, or was there something inside you that said, you know, if not me, who?
I think it's very easy to feel alone, even though you're in a crowd, even though there's everybody there. And when you see your readers talking about it before you, you realize, in fact, you are not alone. And this sounds so stupid and overwrought, but you take a kind of courage because you do want to be talking about things that matter. And I talk about these sorts of issues with such regularity, and they just disappear. There was a gentleman, Shem Walker, who was, I'll never forget, was killed out in Brooklyn. He mistook an undercover cop who was on his mother's stoop for a local tough. Him and the undercover cop got into a scuffle after he tried to evict him off his mother's stoop, and he ended up shot dead. I don't want to replay that case, but I tell you that to say we still don't know who the cop was. All we know is that Shem Walker's dead. And this is contested by no one. And so these sorts of things happen so much that you yourself, even, and it's horrible to admit this, but even as the writer, you can become depressed. You can start to despair. And maybe some little voice in the back of your mind can start to say, does it even matter? Does it really matter? That's a destructive thing that I've just admitted to. But it's there, I think.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Ta-Nehisi Coates is a senior editor for The Atlantic.
Coming up, polls from the Deep South cause a lot of heat, maybe not so much light. And the man who divorced Google.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This weekend is the Louisiana Republican primary. Earlier this month, we saw primaries in Alabama and Mississippi. Much of the attention leading up to those votes was focused on the results of a few poll questions posed to likely Republican primary voters by the democratically affiliated Public Policy Polling. The questions revealed a deep cultural conservatism in the South and a distrust of Barack Obama. What's more, in Alabama, 60% of the respondents do not believe in evolution. In Mississippi, 52% believe Obama is a Muslim. And in South Carolina, 1 in 5 voters believe that interracial marriage should be illegal. Shocking numbers, but even Tom Jensen, a pollster for Public Policy Polling, believes the attention paid to those questions was a bit much.
The level of media coverage of these findings was excessive. Certainly, I would much rather see the media focus on the substance of the presidential race than on some of these quirkier findings.
Writer Michelle Cottle, herself a Southerner, has been keeping tabs on the media's fascination with those poll numbers for the Daily Beast. She says the results are not that revealing or relevant.
You know, if you're talking interracial marriage, that's a stretch, especially for the Republican primary. I don't see Rick Santorum, Newt Gingrich, talking about how we need to go back to Jim Crow.
It's not that you're arguing the data are invalid. It's just that they don't have anything to do with the policy issues at hand.
I mean, I can see an argument that what you want to do is show how socially conservative Southerners are compared to other sections of the country. But they're not asking these questions of other sections of the country. So the fact that, say, 60% of Alabamans don't believe in evolution, well, I hate to break it to people, but the majority of the country isn't buying evolution. I think 40% are strict another close to 40% believe in intelligent design.
The numbers we have, and these are from a poll by the very same Democratic pollster, subsequent to your column, they did a national poll and they discovered that half of the populace believes in evolution, 36 don't, 13% are not sure. But of course, that incorporates this large percentage from the Deep South that categorically doesn't. Clearly, the South is overrepresented in believing in creationism and intelligent design.
Sure. I don't have a problem with that. But the idea that 60% of Alabamans is much different than a chunk of Kansas, unless you're doing this state by state, it's not that enlightening.
Are the media in this case just carrying water for the Democrats in the culture wars?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think based in New York and Washington, the media overwhelmingly shares a lot of the same cultural positions. So I don't think that they're carrying water so much as that they find it completely hysterical when these sorts of things get brought to their attention. Because for the most part, that's when we pay attention to the South. It is kind of seen as this bizarre subculture. They look at these numbers and they're like, oh my God, there are still people who don't believe in interracial marriage, and oh my God, the majority of these people don't believe in evolution.
Let me put it this way. I have traveled from coast to coast and border to border in this great country of ours, and I find that Montana and Arizona are every bit as culturally different from the coasts as the Deep South is. Yet I find the results here just so sort of shockingly retrograde. Am I overreacting?
I don't know. I mean, how do you feel about Arizona's immigration laws?
Well, I don't like them.
Well, there you go. I'm not saying that this isn't appalling that people still harbor these retrograde views. I'm just saying I bet if you polled Boston, you'd find a lot of people with, you know, retrograde racist views as well.
I guess we should observe that the people being polled were the likely voters in a Republican primary in Alabama and Mississippi and so forth, presumably the most conservative of the conservative. Do we have any reason to think that you can extrapolate the attitudes of an entire region from this particular cohort?
No. I mean, we're talking about a fraction of a fraction here. We're talking about a whole bunch of old white folk here. I mean, this is not the New South. This is the dying South for the most part.
I must confess that I am not above stereotyping myself. Like the George Clooney character in Up in the Air says, I like stereotyping. It's faster. But in this case, it was more than just the polling data affirming all of my prejudices about the South. My thought was, really, in 2012, in America?
That's what we're always being reminded by, you know, especially Republican primary candidates. When you have the fight over creationism in Kansas a few years ago, or when you have these really angry rallies with Republican voters in the Midwest. For all of Barack Obama's, we are not a red America and a blue America. We really are in some ways.
Michelle, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Michelle Cottle writes for The Daily Beast. After she wrote her column, public policy polling did ask likely Republican voters in a northern state, Illinois, the same questions they'd asked in Alabama and Mississippi. Turns out 43% of those polled in Illinois, Obama's home state, don't believe in evolution, and 39% of those questioned believe the president is a Muslim. You heard it here first, and maybe last.
What's arguably the greatest strength of the web? The boundless sharing and dissemination of information. What's arguably the biggest problem? The unbridled appropriation and repackaging of information. Is it possible to codify a language of attribution across the internet? Maria Popova of the website brainpickings.org, along with Tina Roth Eisenberg, a.k.a. Swiss Miss, have created what they call the Curator's Code, Unicode icons that you can embed in a blog post or article. That's a shorthand for attribution. A sideways S icon is a via, V-I-A, which attributes and links to the original material. A looping arrow icon represents a hat tip, which will take the reader to where you first encountered the content that you're sharing. The curator's code serves as a kind of breadcrumb trail that allows the reader to trace both the source and inspiration for an article. Maria, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
Let's use a definite example. We learned about you from a piece by David Carr of the New York Times. So the via would lead to your posting of the curator's code, but the hat tip would lead to David Carr.
Right. So the idea of the hat tip is that you found a story lead or idea elsewhere, but you created your own expansion of it and building upon it in a meaningful way. So creating something different. What you're doing is more than repeating the message that was in the Times. You're creating your own original content in a different medium as well around that story lead that you got.
The first one, the via, I think most people can get. You want to go to the original source. The hat tip is, I think, a little more worthy of explanation. I know a lot of reporters would probably prefer not to give a hat tip to where they got the lead that took them to the original source. But you feel that this is also very important. Explain why.
A large part of it has to do with my firm belief that creativity is combinatorial. So we take these existing pieces of knowledge and insight and information, inspiration, and we recombine them into new things. And just last week, I had the pleasure of introducing David Eagleman, the neuroscientist, at his South by Southwest keynote. And he wrote this fascinating book called Incognito about the unconscious processes of the brain. And one thing he mentions in it is that whenever we have an aha moment, it's really that the brain has been consolidating and mulling bits of information for hours or days or years. And this is just the moment in which these bits of information click into a new combination. So the whole idea of the code is that all of our ideas are indebted to other ideas. And the hat tip is a way of recognizing this.
When did you launch the curator's code?
March 10th.
And how many people so far have adopted it? Do you know?
Well, we have no precise way of tracking it. There's been a great deal of response. I've gotten a number of emails saying people really think there's a need for it. We've gotten a lot of pushback, mostly by people who get hung up on the characters themselves and saying, well, we already have a system of attribution. Why do we need the Unicodes? And again, this is not mandated in any way.
You don't care.
We don't care. Not
at
all.
They're quite elegant, but you don't have to adopt
them. No, not at all. But we actually thought about it quite a bit, which characters to choose. And one of the reasons we chose the sideways S-like character for the via is that it looks like half of an infinity symbol. And it plays to this idea that it's all connected. Information is a closed system in which we owe to one another.
You call this an actionable code of ethics. Actionable ethics are very tough to apply in the wild west of the web. You're hoping in some ways to shift the ethos of the web. What do you think the chances are that this could become a standard?
I don't know what the chances are. I know that what's at stake is too important not to try. This is about baking in a level of transparency into how information travels online. And given we live in a quote-unquote information economy, thinking more about the currencies of information, including discovery and attribution, is fundamental to what we make of our information society. But again, it's really about respecting each other as a community of content creators and curators, for lack of a better word. And
I can
sharing.
Tell you're desperate for a better word.
I am desperate. I can't tell you how many people have gotten so hung up on the word that they miss the concept and they miss what's at the heart of it.
What do you think should be a new word?
I
Recombinator?
Think it really doesn't matter, because I think since the beginning of time, editors and curators and journalists and whatever we want to call them have had a sole purpose of information, which is to frame for the audience what matters in the world and why. And an editor can do this in an opinion article and a long feature piece, and a curator can do it by building a pattern of ideas about what matters.
Maybe we should throw that out to the listeners. If you can find a better word for Maria, send it here and we'll pass it along. Maria, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Brooke.
Maria Popova is the founder of BrainPickings.org and the creator of the Curator's Code. You can take a look at it at curatorscode.org. Hat tip, David Carr.
On March 1st, Google enacted a new policy that allows it to pool user information like personal profiles, contact lists, browsing histories from across all of Google's many web services. We're talking about Google Search, YouTube, Blogger, Google Maps, all of it, compiled into what is essentially a comprehensive dossier on you. In response, in the past week, two class action lawsuits were filed against the internet giant. But by then, Tom Henderson, a software researcher in Bloomington, Indiana, had already made a highly personal decision. He decided to file for divorce from Google. Tom, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
First of all, let me say, you know, I'm sorry to hear you're going through this, and I hope it works out well for everybody in the end.
It's tough. I'm kind of glad that Indiana isn't an alimony state.
Yeah, it would be very difficult for you to support Google in the manner to which it has grown accustomed. You wrote a piece detailing the first 7 days of life without Google. What is the process? What do you have to do, not only to your computers, but as a matter of online behavior?
The first thing you have to do is discover what Google services are critical to you. Do you use Google Mail? Do you use Google Voice? Do you use Google Maps? And then you have to find replacements for those. Then you need to shut Google off. And then you have to pretty much armor yourself up because you forget exactly how much you do on the internet if you're a researcher like me. And you'll find yourself going, oh, look at that. I went and found Google again, and oh my goodness, there could be a Google cookie out of this. Let's go look.
Let's talk about cookies, because the tracking that Google and other online providers do, it doesn't happen by magic. It happens because they have embedded little bits of software onto your browser to keep track of where you've been and to be able to reach you easily the next time. What was the process of eradicating cookies and making sure that they didn't find their way onto your browser?
What you have to do is a process of first removing the cookies, then you have to block the cookies, and there are applications for doing this. I use one called Ghostery, which is working very well. And then finally, you have to prevent accidental Google usage, which can happen. And you do that by using a somewhat ancient method of redirecting any requests that your machine might accidentally make to Google.
Now, as a consequence of all this Google avoidance, did you find that you had to settle for inferior services, inferior search, inferior email, inferior mapping, inferior directions, and so forth to make this divorce work?
All of the applications that I use are good enough. The search engine that I use is called DuckDuckGo. DuckDuckGo, unfortunately, does not roll off the tongue as nicely as Google.
Oh, yeah, you'll find it. Just DuckDuckGo it. I don't know.
Yeah, I want to say quack, but it does come up with the right answer that I was looking for in the first few hits, just like Google did. I don't have to scroll past the sponsors, although DuckDuckGo does have sponsors. And in all, it's, you know, very reasonable to use.
You, of course, understand that surrendering privacy is the cost of admission to use these services for free. Privacy has been commodified, and to varying degrees, we surrender it for all sorts of things. Let's just say air travel safety, for example, because there's a benefit. You just don't like the deal. You think you're putting yourself too much at risk in order to have access to all this Google stuff.
In a way, that's accurate, but it's the same reason that I walked into the studio today wearing clothes as opposed to walking in stark naked. It has to do with my sense of modesty, my sense of privacy, and it seems to me that there shouldn't be a quid pro quo that serves Google stockholders that also robs me of my privacy. When I go to DuckDuckGo, I'm doing so with the benefit of knowing that nobody is going to digest what I'm doing and so forth and then reselling it so as to optimize my ad experience or for other analytical data uses. So there is a philosophy behind it, and the philosophy is to regain a bit of my privacy knowing that I'm sacrificing some way cool applications.
What was the hardest to do without?
YouTube. It's really tough.
Now, you're still on LinkedIn. You're still on Twitter. You're still on Facebook. Facebook?
Yes.
Where your life is very much an open book, plus all sorts of data tracking. Are you less exposed now than you were when you filed for divorce?
Yes, I'm less exposed. I have more clothes on. I feel a little bit better about my usage of the internet. In terms of Facebook, I can confine my conversations to the people who are my friends and not broadcast them to the world rather easily, including search engines like Google. But I'm also not going to talk about, you know, my most intimate details, frankly, on Facebook, and I'm kind of cringing at people who really do that. I've thought really overtly at length about what are my relationships and what am I saying here, and do I have a place where I'm completely uncensored and I can say anything that I want to? And to be honest, that's in a closed room with perhaps an open bottle of red wine.
Tom, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. Thanks for having me.
Tom Henderson is the principal researcher for Extreme Labs, Inc. in Bloomington, Indiana.
Coming up, archiving digital bits of dubious distinction and tweeting after you're dead.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, working to help small businesses turn fans into customers with social campaigns. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, for 40 years working to improve health and healthcare, on the web at RWJF.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Once we put photos in a scrapbook. Today we put them on Flickr. Once we chronicled our days in a diary, now we update our Facebook page. Once we kept Super 8 movies of our kids, these days we post videos on YouTube. Once upon a time, we also put things on GeoCities and Friendster and Google Video, but now they're long gone. Well, Jason Scott operates on the premise that every repository of user-generated content online will one day die, but that the content we put there is worth saving. He leads an ad hoc group of archivists called the Archive Team who swoop in to salvage material when a site is closing. Still, he wishes the users would render his service obsolete, and so he urges everyone who begins to post to prepare for the end.
Anytime you want to join up with anything, any kind of service that lets you do things for free, the first question is, where is your export function? Where can I grab a copy from your site of the material? If they say, we're working on it, then they're lying to you. It should be as easy for them to do that as anything else. So if they do have an export function, use it. People put their lives online and then one day wake up and realize it's not there anymore. They are keeping their memories on spinning magnetic pieces of metal.
That somebody else owns.
Yes.
Set the scene for me. You get the notice of some service that is on its way out. What do you do?
It's helpful to understand that there's a whole bunch of services out there where you might have millions of accounts. Things like GeoCities, Friendster, you know, even places like Foursquare and Flickr, where people have been encouraged to, for free, upload things they made or are doing. And then at some point, someone moves a checkmark from column A to column B, and they decide, after this next financial quarter, I think we'll be taking this down. And the amount of time they give you is basically random. I've seen everything from 6 months to 48 hours. And all these people who may not have even thought about this site for years suddenly are having it taken away. They may not be alive. They may not know how to get to their old account. They may not be checking that email. And so what we did was come up with this idea of the archive team, a collection of archivists, developers, and we would do our best to take one snapshot of the place, put it into an archive, give people the option of getting some of their data back.
Give me some examples. What sites have you rushed in to salvage what is stored there?
There were a couple of sites that did podcasts, Podango, My Podcast. And what would happen is they would literally give you 4 or 5 days to get off. Thousands of shows, thousands of episodes. So we go in and we've pulled down hundreds and hundreds of shows and thousands of episodes. Poetry.com, that was a company where people were basically making their poems available. And it had about 14 million written poems. And the company basically announced, we're shutting down. We're going to give you about a month. Hope you enjoyed your time with your poetry. So we went in and we started downloading it. And what we discovered to our great surprise was they started blocking us from downloading the poetry.
What was the relationship between you and the authors at the time? Did they express frustration that they couldn't get at their own stuff?
One of the things that always breaks our heart is that one of these companies will announce they're shutting down and they'll put it into a blog post. Goodbye, it's been great. And then all the comments will be, please help me. How do I save this? I can't find my husband's password. He died 2 years ago. You know, we get compared to firemen. You go in and you try to grab what you can. So we grabbed the most popular poems based on their viewer counts, and then we tried to sequentially go through and get as many poems as we could.
Well, there's a little vigilantism you're describing here. Tell me about the legality.
Oh, man. You know, the thing is, we all know that this country is a little psychotic about copyright, right? I mean, just a little bit. We're not selling what we're putting here. We're not putting ads on it and putting it back up again. We're definitely not giving it to other businesses and selling it to them, you know? Some of these things have no commercial value whatsoever. Some of them might have commercial value, but the fact is we are literally being that guy that hopefully in 20 years, 50 years, someone goes, oh, thank goodness they were there at that point. Sites that block us are extremely rare because we find these companies have actually given up not just watching them, but even caring about them.
Now, much of what anyone posts is trivial. And if it gets lost, who cares? Is most of what you bring back just kind of, I don't know, junk?
You know, the example that I give is a Civil War letter to a wife from her husband who's on the front lines. It might be the most trivial thing, just saying, hope the cows are okay, hope you're fine. There's so much other information coded in there. There could be a watermark showing that a company that said it never worked for that side did, in fact, sell paper to that side. It could be a certain kind of ink. It could be that that one front guy became a general, and this is one of the few cases of him signing his own name. I know it's a stretch, but there are people right now taking some of the things we download and doing cultural analysis. This is what happens when life went online. This is what happened when people reached a larger audience than their genetic line had ever reached. What did they do given that power? And so even though we might objectively say this is trivial, I wouldn't want these read out to me one by one forever, everything historical that we see is because a whole line of people said, let's not throw out that box. Let's not delete that tape. Let's not get rid of those pictures. And I don't want to be the guy who decided, okay, this is good, this is bad, and then 100 years later be hated.
Jason, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jason Scott leads the archive team. The impulse to archive, to preserve something fleeting, isn't restricted to things that most people think are worth saving. Michael Dennis is a co-founder of fanchants.co.uk, a website that has captured 20,000 soccer fan chants from around the world. Chants are the organic, fan-generated soundtrack to soccer. The venture began as a business idea, but for its organizers has become a strange, addictive archiving endeavor.
Michael, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Before I ask you why in the world you're out preserving soccer fan chants, and I can, believe me, hardly wait to hear the answer to that question, what exactly are soccer fan chants? We don't have anything quite like that in the US.
It's essentially a song that's made up by the fans of a football team. It can be a long-standing, inspiring anthem that's sung at every game, or it can be sung once and never sung again. Usually a good match will have 40 or 50 songs sung, sometimes twice that.
How do 40,000 people know the same chants?
You decide on your team when you're a kid. You listen to it a couple of times. Eventually, those songs sort of are etched into your brain forever. Or if it's one of those songs that starts in the crowd, it'll start with one guy in a corner who sees something funny, starts a couple of verses of something, then it can end up being sung by the whole stadium. One of my favourites is from my team, Leeds. There was a guy getting married on the pitch, and then some wag in the crowd just started singing, "You don't know what you're doing, you don't know what you're doing.
You mentioned anthems as a recurring theme. These are a bit more lofty. They evince the supporters' pride for their teams.
There's only one or two anthems that each club has. They're sung at every game in full voice. And I've been to some games where the hairs on my whole body have just been on end. Flower of Scotland, when the Scottish sing it, is pretty amazing.
So one of your favorites is for a team called Manchester City, and they have a striker by the name of Mario Balotelli, and he's got a chant all for his own self.
He's a real character. He's just a young guy, 19. He won £25,000 at a casino and just drove around giving £1,000 each to each homeless person that he saw. But he had to be taken off in a game because he had an allergic reaction to grass. One of the lines is he's got an allergy to grass, but he plays and he's effing class.
Underwrote your journeys to 720 teams to collect 20,000 chants. And how long has it taken?
We've been doing this for 5 years. I rather fortunately sold a travel business that I founded in Australia. So I had a little bit of money and I was looking around for something to do. And I went to the game and recorded some chants on my camera and went home with my friend. And his phone went off, and it was one of those old ringtones. It was nee, 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 nee. It was the man. I said, no, this is what you want. I just loaded it onto the computer, roared it out of the speakers. We saw two light bulbs appear above our heads. And
chants as ringtones. That's the business?
That's how it started. Now I'm more into the side of, you know, it's a historical and cultural archive of the football fans throughout the ages.
So you have somehow backed into being an ethnographer.
If I knew what that was, I could actually tell you the yes or no. Sorry.
You know, there are people who collect the last recordings of dying languages or cultural rites for study by anthropologists and sociologists and linguists. And you've got 20,000 football chants. Where do you think this puts you in the pantheon of social scientists?
Considering that half the world either plays or watches football, I'd say I was right up there, if not the top.
Well, Michael, thank you so much.
No problem at all. It's been a pleasure.
Michael Dennis is a co-founder of fanchants.co.uk. And what you're now hearing at the insistence of our senior producer, Katya Rogers, is a fan chant for her favorite team, Arsenal.
With social media, so much of our interactions with the world now live online, even after we may not be living at all. But how do you handle your online presence posthumously? In Oklahoma, there's a law that allows estate executors access to the departed's online accounts. But at last week's South by Southwest, James Norris launched a website called Dead Social, which allows people to posthumously update their social media. James, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so how did you come up with the idea of Dead Social?
In England, there was a very well-known talk show host and comedian called Bob Monkhouse. A few years ago, before he passed away, he created a video about prostate cancer, and it was only shown after he'd passed away.
In that public service announcement, he says, 4 years ago, I died.
Just when you thought it was safe to turn on your TV again, here I am. Gosh, 4 years already. Doesn't time fly? What killed me kills one man per hour in Britain. That's even more than my wife's cooking. Let's face it, as a comedian...
It was such a powerful message and video. And soon after, I came up with an idea, initially a Twitter hack called Grave Tweeter. You would create a series of tweets that would only be sent out once you've passed away. Since then, I've evolved the offering hugely, and now it addresses it in a much more delicate way and a much more suitable way that should appeal to the general population who's online and active within different social networks.
How does Dead Social know you're dead?
A user will need to give access to somebody who they know, love, or trust. They would then be able to start the mechanism rolling once you've passed away. We are building a separate mechanism, the Dead Man Switch, which will be a user-defined amount of time. Say, for example, a user uses Facebook every day. They may say, right, if I don't log into Facebook over the course of a week, I may be on holiday. If it's a month, then, yeah, I'm probably dead. But but if it's 2 months or whatever the user thinks is relevant for them, they will be sent an email asking them to please confirm that they're still with us. If they don't respond after the second email, that's when the messages will be sent out.
If you have left the determination of your death to Dead Social, Dead Social will send you a couple of emails before making it official.
That's correct, yes.
And then what does it do?
It allows you to send out a series of scheduled messages to your Facebook, Twitter, and Google Plus account, which really allows you to extend your digital legacy. It allows you to amplify the voice and the personality that you had in life. There's no reason why once we've passed away that we should stop being able to send out information and distribute content and make people not only aware but keep them up to date with how we used to live and how we were.
Keep them up to date with how we used to live. That's just plain strange, James. Mm-hmm. The people who are excited by this, what do they say they want to use it for?
Well, that's the thing. It's totally down to the individual. Some people will want to say their final goodbyes. Some people may want to have a virtual relationship with their unborn grandchildren. There's a plethora of different ways in which the platform can be used. And these range from your simple daily interactions to something that's more secretive or more exciting or more kind of sensitive that possibly was unable to be said at the time.
Things like, here's where I buried all that money.
If only, yes. Now, if that material has been created solely for distribution after the individual has passed away, then the strength and the power and the poignancy of whatever message is said is amplified tenfold.
Well, right now, Dead Social allows you to update Google+, Facebook, and so on. But 10, 20, 30 years from now, those platforms may not exist. What happens to Dead Social then?
All of the information that's sent out is also made available on the user's private Dead Social account. If new social platforms are made available and the user is still alive, then we will allow them to integrate the next big social network into Dead Social. If not, it would be unethical and immoral for us to create an account on their behalf.
What about my great-grandchild? If the right to my information passes down to her, can she go converting it to new social platforms?
Yeah, I mean, if
did I just give you an inspiration?
You did, yeah. It's he or she could by all means create an account on a social network that's still to be launched.
So the response to all this has been phenomenal, but a decent part of this response has relied heavily on the word creepy. What do you think about that?
In the Western world, we're awful at approaching death. Death approaches us before we approach it. I fully understand why the word creepy has been used. However, when you benchmark that against the value of receiving the messages, I think the word will be diluted with other words much more pleasant going forward. If we're lucky on our deathbed, we may be able to say goodbye to our family and our close friends. But we've got wider communities now. By integrating Dead Social into your digital will, if you like, you're really able to say those goodbyes, whether it's a traditional kind of farewell goodbye or whether it's more tailored and personal to individuals. Again, it's really down to the user.
Okay, James, thanks very much.
Thank you.
James Norris is the creator of Dead Social, on the web at deadsoci.al.
Casper, the friendly ghost, the friendliest ghost you know. Though grown-ups might look at him with fright, the children all love him so. He always says hello, and he's really glad to meet you wherever he may go. He's kind to every living creature.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurkhman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Robert Schoon and Louisa Beck, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.